Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone is doing well. Hope your practice is going well. So this morning we are going to finish the Satipatthana Sutta that we've been talking through over the last few mornings. There's quite a bit to cover, but I want to do something a little bit different tomorrow morning. So we're going to finish the Satipatthana today. That means there's lots to cover, and so again, I'll be taking questions at the end rather than as we go through, because I'm really keen that we do get to the end. So yesterday we started the fourth Satipatthana, and we had the practices of looking at cause and effect around the five hindrances, and looking at impermanence and the five aggregates. And so moving on, next we have the practice of the six sense bases or sense spheres. Again, in regard to dhammas, one abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the six internal and external sense spheres. And how does one, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the six internal and external sense spheres? Here, one knows the eye, one knows forms, and one knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. And one also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. And then in the same form of words, one knows the ear and sounds, the nose and odours, the tongue and flavours, the body and tangibles, the mind and mind objects. And just mentioning the ear and sounds, right now someone's using some kind of gardening equipment or power tool or something out of the back of my house, and there have been RAF jets flying overhead this morning, so if there's a certain amount of background noise going on, yeah, I'm not in the middle of an earthquake or anything, it's just a noisy place to be this morning. So, we have these six internal and external sense spheres. The internal and external bit, this is talking about the sense organ and the sense object. And we've already had a discussion about sense organs and sense objects and sense consciousnesses and so on. And I don't propose to rehash that. The key point, which again we've already mentioned, but just to highlight, the sixth sense that's being talked about here is relating to thought, it's relating to mental activity. So we've got the eye and what we can see, the ear and what we can hear, the nose and what we can smell, the tongue and what we can taste, the body and what we can touch and feel, and the mind or the brain, if you prefer, and the thoughts, the mental objects that come through our experience. Now, if you're into modern science, you might be thinking, oh, but there's more senses than that. And yeah, depending on whose list you prefer, there's anything from 9 to over 50 senses that are recognized in some branches of modern science. Some of the key ones that show up in pretty much all of the lists, they make a distinction between tactile sensations, the kind of normal touch sensations, what it feels like when you rub your hand against something. And then other forms of body sensation, like our sense of temperature. Is it warm? Is it cool? The sense of pain. Does it hurt? The sense of balance or equilibrium. You know, are we right side up? Are we off to one side? Are we upside down? And proprioception, the sense of where the body is in space and what posture the body is in. So if you're sitting there thinking, but hang on a minute, the Buddhist list of senses is incomplete, then yeah, you can feel free to either have, I don't know, 10 sense spheres if you want those extra ones, or you can lump all of those in with the body and feelings, whatever you prefer. It doesn't really matter. The point here is to examine your sensory experience. This practice is very much not about what you think about what's going on. It's about what you can experience going on. So to an extent, all of these theoretical models about, well, this is how experience comes along, and this happens, then this, and this, and this. This practice is, in a sense, asking us to set that aside and look to see what do our senses actually tell us. It's not because what our senses tell us is necessarily closer to ultimate truth or anything like that, but this is a visceral practice. It's about getting us to look at what's actually going on, not seeing it through the lens of what we think is going on. Certainly in my own practice, I've often got tangled up by looking for what I think should be there, or seeing what I expect to see, or seeing things in the way that I think about them. And I've often found that if I can turn more towards the direct experience of my senses, that has helped in my meditation. Now, simply exploring a sensory experience, both in terms of the externally oriented senses, the five senses, and our inner landscape, the mental sense, that can be a practice in its own right. And there's all sorts of ways to do that. Yeah, a common one, and I know a number of people on this retreat have practiced in the Mahasi tradition, you've done the noting practice. And there are ways of using noting, so you can just note which sense door your attention is being drawn to. Yeah. See, hear, hear, see. Feel, see, that kind of thing. And that can take you in the direction of impermanence. It can take you all sorts of interesting places. But that kind of bare noting practice is not really what this discourse is getting at in this context, I would say. Because it doesn't just stop at here one knows the eye and one knows forms, here one knows the ear and one knows sounds. No, there's an extra instruction. Here, one knows the eye, one knows forms, and one knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. And one also knows how an unarisen fetter can arise, how an arisen fetter can be removed, and how a future arising of the removed fetter can be prevented. So, first thing to say, we have this new word that hasn't shown up in the discourse so far, a fetter. What's a fetter? Well, there's a few different lists of fetters, actually, in the Pali Canon. There's quite a number of them. They turn up in different places. We could view this simply as another term for an unwholesome state. So we have some sensory experience, and that leads us into an unwholesome state. We are fettered by that unwholesome state to the extent that we're caught in it and we're unable to extricate ourselves from it. And so in that respect, these instructions look very much like the same instructions that we had relating to the hindrances, right? One knows the arising of one of the hindrances. You learn what causes it to arise. You figure out how to get it to cease, and you figure out how to prevent its future arising. But there's also what we might call a list of capital F fetters, the 10 fetters. And this is one of the more important lists. It's probably the best known set of fetters as well. And the 10 fetters are the fetters that relate to the four stages of awakening. Now, Lee has already outlined these in a previous talk, but it might not hurt to go through them again, because often people are interested in the early Buddhist model of awakening and what it looks like to move through the progressive stages. So we have these four stages of awakening. And at the first stage, stream entry, the first three of the 10 fetters are eliminated. These are the fetters of identity view, the idea that there's a fixed findable me, that there's an essence to me that's in here somewhere. We see for sure that, yeah, that ain't so. That's just not how it is. Then there's sometimes called rites and rituals, or sometimes you see rites, rituals, and righteousness, because we love a good bit of alliteration. So this can be interpreted a couple of ways. If you lean more towards rites and rituals, then the sense might be something like, yeah, at stream entry, you understand that to the extent that you've woken up, you've done so through practice. It's not a matter of paying a priest to burn some incense for you and then, boom, enlightenment arrives through sheer grace. You actually have to bring yourself along for the ride as well. You have to do the practice yourself. If we interpret it as rites, rituals, and righteousness, then there's more of a connotation that, given the emphasis that's placed on sila, ethical conduct, and so on, you might get the impression that if you just, you know, have really, really good sila, then, well, that's the same as being awakened, isn't it? Because awakened beings are known for having really good sila. And so if I just practice really good sila, then, yeah, that's the same thing, isn't it? Or perhaps a little bit more, I don't know the word, but Sinister is the word that's coming up. That's not quite what I mean. Well, maybe I'll stop trying to find a word for it. But what can happen sometimes is you see a spiritual community with a teacher at the head, and a lot of the people who have been hanging out in that community start to look and sound a lot like the teacher. They say the same things the teacher says. They behave the same way the teacher does. It's like if you copy the behavior of the person at the front of the room, then somehow that means you're more awakened somehow. The people I've met whose practice seems to me to be the deepest are very much uniquely themselves. They are not in the mold of anyone else. And yeah, aping someone else's behavior, there seem to be some pretty strong limitations to that. And yeah, again, with stream entry, your practice has gone to a sufficient depth that you can see that, yeah, you have to do this for yourself, and it's not enough to just copy the person next to you or the person at the front. You have to, yeah, someone's suggesting cultish, that's quite a nice word for it, actually. That kind of cult of personality, everyone ends up kind of wearing the same colored robes and all that. Yeah. Second fetter, it's not about that. And the third fetter is doubt. Does this even work? Is this just a bunch of hippie nonsense? Is this a giant con intended to get people to donate money? Is it all just about increasing my fleet of gold-plated Rolls-Royces? Yeah, all of these kinds of doubts can come up, particularly when we're having a hard time in the practice. And yet, with stream entry, yeah, we've gone beyond the point where we can reasonably say, I'm not sure if this practice does anything, because we've crossed the threshold. We've seen for sure. Yeah, okay. I might not be enjoying my practice right now, but I can't deny that it's doing something. This path does lead somewhere. It does work. So that's the first stage. Identity view, rites, rituals, and righteousness, and doubt. Then at the second stage of awakening, so-called once returner, the second stage doesn't eliminate any of the fetters, but it does weaken the fourth and fifth fetters. The fourth and fifth fetters are sensual desire on the one hand, gotta have nice stuff, nice to have nice things, we want nice things, and ill will, which is the opposite. It's aversion. It's the opposite of metta, right? Metta is goodwill. You wish that all beings be well. Ill will is the opposite of that. It's wishing harm. I wish that person would just fall off a cliff or whatever. So the second stage is said to weaken these two fetters, sensual desire and ill will. And yeah, long-time practitioners definitely report a decrease in the extent to which they find themselves caught up in sense desire and ill will, as you would expect, I guess. It's at the third stage, though, non-returner, that these are said to be eliminated entirely. There are different interpretations about what it means to eliminate a fetter entirely. I don't propose to go into that because we'll be here all day. But traditionally, it is said that at the third stage of awakening, you eliminate the fetters of sense desire and ill will. So with three stages in, we've got rid of half the fetters. That means there's still five of them to go. And the last five are the stubborn ones, evidently. These are the five that are eliminated at full awakening, arahantship. Six and seven are something like attachment to form and formless, sometimes interpreted as a desire for rebirth in particular form realms or formless realms. There's a whole Buddhist cosmology about all the different realms that are out there, and some of them that you could be reborn in are really cool. So maybe you've gone a certain way through your practice, but you still think, yeah, wouldn't it be nice to be reborn in some amazing heaven where everything's glorious all the time? There's that sense of wanting to, yeah, go to heaven when you die, or maybe there's a bit of that, what Lee calls the immortality project. So those go away at full awakening. Fetter number eight is restlessness. I think we've all had a bit of restlessness on this retreat, and so maybe it's not the best news in the world that restlessness doesn't go away until full awakening. But at least it means that if restlessness is still coming up, well, yeah, that's going to be the case for most people. It's a normal thing to happen. Doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. Doesn't mean your practice is broken. It just means that you haven't quite reached the Buddha's level yet. So, yeah, keep going. Fetter number nine is conceit. conceiving of a self. So at the first stage of awakening, we see through our belief in a fixed self, but there's a certain amount of momentum behind that. We've been practicing feeling like a self for our whole lives. Developing a sense of individuality, of selfhood, was an important part of our developmental process. It was an important part of becoming an individual, no longer being dependent on our parents. So yeah, it continues to feel like we have a self right the way up to full awakening. It is said that that's fully uprooted when you get there. And the 10th fetter is ignorance. So this whole path has been about seeing more and more clearly what's going on. And when you reach full awakening, done is what needed to be done. You now see what's really going on. Your ignorance has been uprooted. And as Lee was saying, I think it was last night, doesn't mean you're never going to make a mistake again, but it means that as far as the Dharma is concerned, you're now seeing things in a way that's much more closely aligned with how our experience actually works, what it actually means to be alive and be having this conscious experience. We're now free from the various delusions that were leading us into suffering. So, if we're treating the fetters in the context of this discourse as any unwholesome state, then yeah, we already know how to work with those, right? And a couple of the 10 fetters, actually, sense pleasure, ill will, we can look at those as being the craving and the aversion of the hindrances. We can maybe look at the restlessness of the fetters as being related to the restlessness and remorse of the hindrances. So we already know what we're doing here. It's about noticing when our sense experience leads us into unwholesome states, figuring out how to get ourselves out of that unwholesome state and avoiding doing it in the future. It's about learning the cause and effect of our experience. But if we're interested in the 10 fetters, then another couple of very interesting fetters that we can pick out are identity, view, and conceit. So now we're pointing more to the anatta quality of the three characteristics, right? This sense of self, this thing that seems to be very central to the practice. And so one of the things we can explore is how that sense of self comes up as part of our sensory experience. What actually is your sense of yourself? Can you find it? Can you pin it down? Is it a feeling in the body? Is it a thought? What actually is it? And how does it arise? As you go through your day and you notice various things and you notice, oh, that's mine. Well, there's the arising of a sense of me, because if that thing is mine, then there must be a me to own it. There are times when maybe we don't have a strong sense of me and mine, and then something triggers it to arise. So a really interesting practice is watching our sensory experience and noticing when a sense of self arises, and again, what triggered it, but also how we recognize it. And the more we explore this sense of me, again, I'm hesitant to sort of lead the witness and tell you what you might find, but I'd say it's common to find that this sense of me is a bit of a moving target. Some of the time it's kind of over here, and then it's over here, and then it's this other thing. Well, now it feels like this, and then another time it's up here. And yeah, if you study it long enough, if you kind of follow it around, then eventually the illusion falls apart. So this is the practice with the sense spheres. We have at least three good ways of working with this practice. We could simply notice our sensory experience, maybe through noting or a different practice, and see impermanence. We could notice the arising of unwholesome states and learn the cause and effect of them. We can notice our sense of self and investigate it in relation to our sixth sense experience. And of course, we have the refrain. We're supposed to do this internally, externally, and both. We all have senses. We all have fetters. We're supposed to look at this arising, passing, and impermanence more generally. And yes, sensory experience is impermanent. And we're supposed to do this. Mindfulness is established in oneself to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. So once again, we're interested in the sensory experience, not so much the stories about the sensory experience, not so much being drawn into the content, but the bare sensory experience as close as we can get to it. It's not to say that we want to live our lives at bare sensory experience and never have another thought again as long as we live, but as an exercise, as a way of exploring our experience, getting as close as we can to the raw experience without all the layers of thinking and processing and sankharas and papancha and all that business. So that's the practice of the six sense spheres. Next, we have the practice of the awakening factors, or the seven factors of awakening. Again, in regard to dhammas, one abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the seven awakening factors. And how does one, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the seven awakening factors? Here, if the mindfulness awakening factor is present in oneself, one knows there is the mindfulness awakening factor in me. If the mindfulness awakening factor is not present in oneself, one knows there is no mindfulness awakening factor in me. One knows how the unarisen mindfulness awakening factor can arise, and how the arisen mindfulness awakening factor can be perfected by development. And again, the same form of words for the subsequent six factors. So we start with the mindfulness awakening factor, and then investigation of dharmas, energy, piti, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So we know if each of these awakening factors is present in ourselves or not, and if it's not, one knows how the unarisen factor can arise and how it can be maintained and developed to perfection. Now I've mentioned kind of throughout that this is a big anthology of practices, and some of them are common to all of the versions of the sutta. And in the fourth Satipatthana, the mindfulness of dharmas, the two practices that show up everywhere are mindfulness of the hindrances and mindfulness of the awakening factors. So we might say that the core of this fourth Satipatthana is looking at the cause and effect of wholesome and unwholesome states and applying the four great efforts to those. So we know if we're in an unwholesome state, we know how to get out of it, and we know how to avoid falling back into it again. We know how to get ourselves into a wholesome state and maintain it and bring it to perfection. So we can look at this whole fourth Satipatthana really about understanding not just the presence or absence of wholesome and unwholesome states, which is the third Satipatthana. This is taking it a step further. This is looking at the cause and effect in our experience. So just running through those seven factors of awakening again, in case people aren't familiar with those. First one is mindfulness. We've been talking about mindfulness all the way through. Being present, you've got to show up to your experience. Otherwise, yeah, it's just not going to go that well. Mindfulness is core to really all of the practices we've been looking at on this retreat, whether they're concentration or insight or whatever else. You've got to be there. You've got to be present. If you're off and away and lost in stuff, then yeah, that constitutes a distraction. And once you notice you got distracted, which takes as long as it takes, then you come back and you re-establish mindfulness. Second, we have investigation of dharmas, inquiry. Now, this is not so much a part of the concentration side of practice, because in concentration, we're more interested in stabilizing the attention. But as soon as we start thinking about insight and wisdom, then, yeah, investigation of dharmas, inquiry, looking to see what's going on. That becomes very important. Next, we have energy. And yeah, we've probably all experienced what it's like not to have enough energy for the practice. You sit down, you've got some time to meditate, and then you just fall asleep. It's useful to have energy, it keeps us going. It's especially useful to have energy when the practice is getting tough, because it will keep us persisting through those difficulties. But we need it all the time. If we don't have any energy, then yeah, we're not going to be able to practice well. Next, we have piti, the fourth factor of awakening. You'll often see this translated as joy. The Pali word is piti. Lee feels very strongly that it should not be translated as joy. And so we're calling it piti, even though you'll probably more commonly see it as joy. But the Pali word is piti. Now, are we talking about the kind of pervasive, really strong piti that you get in the first jhana? Maybe, maybe not. I've heard arguments in both directions as to whether the jhanas feature in this list of awakening factors or not. I think in this context, it's probably talking more about the lower grades of piti where you've just got kind of pleasurable sensations in the body. And we can see how that's supportive for practice, because if the body feels awful, then it's really hard to want to keep going. Whereas if the body's feeling good, if there's kind of, nice sensations in the body, then it helps to keep us sitting, keep us practicing. Next, we have tranquility, peace of mind, calmness. Often in the early Zen tradition, the purpose of practice was described as to find peace of mind. Tranquility is a nice thing. Then we have concentration, indistractability. We don't need to talk more about concentration than we already have on this retreat, I think. And lastly, we have equanimity, this kind of stability, this solid ground, this equipoise, a balanced state. And this empowers investigation. It's another way that can help us to get through hard times, to face whatever's coming. There are places in the suttas where the Buddha has run through a whole bunch of, well, if something really difficult's coming up, you could try this, you could try this, you could try this. And when all of those have failed and you've run out of everything else, then you can abide in equanimity. Yeah. This too shall pass. Sometimes you just got to get through stuff. Now, sometimes you find these seven factors of awakening split up into three groups, what are called the balancing factors. And you have energizing factors on the one hand and calming factors on the other, and then a kind of pivot in the middle. The energizing factors are investigation of dharmas, energy, and piti. These are all things which kind of have an up quality to them. We're investigating, we're exploring. That's an active thing. Energy, we've got some get up and go. We want to keep moving. We want to sit up straight and keep going. Piti, yeah, if we've had piti going on this retreat, that has a quality of energizing the body. And so the suggestion is, if you're finding that practice is very sluggish, very dull, you're getting into that sinking place, then looking to boost the energizing factors can really help. Looking a bit more closely, adding a bit of investigation, bringing a bit more energy into the practice can help to bring us out of that sinking mind kind of place. The counterbalance is the calming factors: tranquility, concentration, equanimity. These have a settling quality. And yeah, when we're restless and agitated, it's good to boost the calming factors if we can find a way to do that. And the pivot in the middle, the balancing factor, is mindfulness. Mindfulness tells us what's needed in any given moment. If we're in a pretty balanced place already, if we've got a good balance of energy and calmness, then yeah, that's fine. But if we're starting to droop, then we need to perk up a bit. If we're starting to get a bit overexcited, we need to calm down a bit. And mindfulness will tell us sort of what direction that seesaw is pointing in, and which way we need to course correct. Another use of the awakening factors, which I think we mentioned on like the first morning or something like that, really quite early on, is that these things can also be seen as a kind of map of how practice might unfold, as a natural consequence of one another. And you can find this in the Anapanasati Sutta, amongst others. So let's say you're going to read a book. And I'm assuming that you like to read books. If you don't like to read books, then this is maybe not the analogy for you, but just pretend for the moment that you do like reading books and just go with it. So you want to read a book and you pick up the book. Well, first things first, you've got to establish some mindfulness. If you're still thinking about that thing that happened earlier today, then you might be turning the pages, but you're not really reading. So you start with mindfulness. Now, next comes investigation. It's a new book. You don't know what it's like. You've maybe heard good things about it, but you want to know for yourself what's this book actually like? Because, maybe you're going to hate the writing style, maybe whatever else. So you need to check it out. You need to look at it for yourself. Investigation. Is this an interesting book? And so you start reading, you start looking. Turns out, yeah, it is quite interesting, actually. Oh, this is pretty good. Hey, it's going to mention that thing that I have questions about. Energy is arising. It's interesting. You want to keep going. You're starting to perk up a little bit and really get into it. And as you continue to read, this is the stuff I've been really looking for. I've been looking so long for. PT, you're starting to feel really good in yourself. You're starting to feel that kind of physical sense of being really energized. And so as the book goes on, of course, you can't maintain that high level of excitation for a long time, but as you keep reading, your body starts to settle. You relax, you sit back into your chair, you're going to be here for a while now. Forget the other thing. Forget about the tax return. You're going to read this book for a while. Tranquility is settling in. You're becoming less concerned with the other things around you, becoming more focused on what's going on. And as you continue to read, you become more and more absorbed in the book, and external sounds fall away and you lose track of time. You're concentrated, you're absorbed in the book, you're not getting distracted anymore. And as this deepens, yeah, you get to a place where, yeah, trucks could be driving past, jets could be flying overhead. Doesn't bother you. You're completely in the activity of reading now. There's no longer any part of you that's left out of the activity of reading. You are 100% there. There's no gap. You have arrived at equanimity. Nothing bothers you. You're good. So we can see this maybe as a map of the best meditation session you've ever had. You start with mindfulness, you start by remembering, yeah, okay, I need to be here to do this practice. You move into investigation. All right, what am I going to explore? And as the exploration investigation develops, yeah, it's actually quite interesting. You start to get energized, you start to feel good, you get peaty. And the longer you stay in it, then the body begins to settle, you become tranquil, the mind becomes focused, you become concentrated, you become imperturbable, you develop equanimity. So, the seven factors of awakening. And of course, again, we have the refrain. We recognize that internally, externally, and universally, we all have wholesome mind states. We're all capable of arousing these factors of awakening. Arising, passing, and impermanence, these two come and go. Just because you were super on it in your last meditation session doesn't necessarily mean the next one's going to be like that. We have good sits and bad sits, good times of day, bad times of day. Good days, bad days, good months, bad months, and so on and so forth. And bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. Once again, it's not about beating yourself up because you only have three of the seven factors of awakening going. It's about learning, understanding cause and effect. And then next, we come to the Four Noble Truths. This is the list of lists, right? The Buddhist list par excellence. Again, in regard to dhammas, one abides contemplating dhammas in terms of the Four Noble Truths. And how does one, in regard to dhammas, abide contemplating dhammas in terms of the Four Noble Truths? Here, one knows as it really is. This is dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the arising of dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the cessation of dukkha. One knows as it really is. This is the way leading to the cessation of dukkha. So I think I mentioned at the beginning of the retreat that we were using the version of the Satipatthana Sutta that you find in the middle length discourses, Majjhima Nikaya 10. There's also a version of this discourse in the long discourses, Digha Nikaya 22. The only difference between the two is that Majjhima has what I just read out for the Four Noble Truths, whereas Digha Nikaya 22 has an enormously long unpacking of the Four Noble Truths. It's really good stuff. It's really interesting. It's well worth looking at some point. But we only have so much time today. We've already covered multiple practices. We're already sort of right in the sort of danger zone for information overload, so I'm not about to read another 20 paragraphs or however much it is of even more information. Let's just stop here with the Four Noble Truths. It's the heart of the Dharma, right? This was the Buddha's original spiritual question. What are we going to do about dukkha? The Four Noble Truths invite us to see and fully understand our dukkha. Sensory experience is not a reliable source of lasting happiness. We're invited to see and fully understand the arising of our dukkha, to understand what it is that causes us to suffer, to see how we create our own suffering, to see the cessation of dukkha and how that can come about. Again, cause and effect here. Going beyond just finding a way out of an individual unwholesome state, how do we find a way out of dukkha? Seeing the cessation of dukkha that can come from the practice or from other sources. And cultivating the path of practice that leads to a more consistent, more dependable cessation of dukkha. There's been a very big theme in the whole fourth Satipatthana about cause and effect. And if I was so minded, I could tie that to Lee's talks on dependent origination. Remember, he was talking about the general principle of dependent origination, this, that conditionality. That's another way of saying cause and effect. But I think sometimes it can also be helpful to talk about things in much simpler terms, to put down all of the technical language and all of that stuff. Yeah, we talk a lot about insight practice and three characteristics and dependent origination and all this stuff. That stuff is great, don't get me wrong. I love it to bits. It's been enormously useful for me. But sometimes we can keep it simple, and that works too. Understanding the cause and effect in our lives is a really powerful thing. There's a Zen teacher called Brad Warner, who recently wrote a book about Buddhist ethics and in the context of Zen practice. And the book begins as follows. You are the universe, but you keep punching yourself in the face. So stop doing that. That's all there is to say. The end. There is then more of the book beyond that. He does eventually conclude that, yeah, he probably can't just stop there. But that's the gist of it. Figure out what you're doing, which is causing suffering for yourself, and stop doing it. Cause and effect. It's so simple that it can seem like, oh yeah, you know, I mean, that's just kid stuff. And now I know proper Dharma. I know that the deeper things, the fancier things. Spending time understanding the basic cause and effect in our experience is one of the most powerful things you can do. And actually, it's one of the deepest things you can do as well. So just because the language is simple, don't write it off as being like, you know, mindfulness 101, the kind of stuff you tell people on baby's first meditation course. This is the heart of what's going on. This is the Four Noble Truths. And of course, the refrain, internally, externally, in both, yeah, we're not that special. Suffering is a universal phenomenon. Arising, passing, and impermanence, our suffering comes and goes. There was a thing that my dad used to say to me when I was very small and I was stressing out about something that was going to happen at school the next day. And he would always tell me to remember the 24-hour rule. 24 hours from now, whatever it is I'm worrying about tomorrow will have been and gone. And yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that, actually. These things all come and go. And to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness, as we're looking at suffering, it can be a sticky place to go. There's all kinds of stories. Maybe we have a sense of victimhood, of this wasn't my fault, of if only this hadn't happened, then all these kinds of things can come up. As we're looking at suffering, it's very easy to be drawn into those stories about what's going on. There's a time and a place for that. Talking through some of those stories with someone who's a good listener and potentially a trained therapist can be an incredibly valuable thing to do. But from the perspective of insight meditation, We're trying to first and foremost learn about what's going on here. At least teacher Iyakema would say, when you find yourself experiencing suffering, ask yourself a question. What are you learning from your discontent? Because if you're not learning anything from it, then you're having a miserable experience, and that's as far as it goes, right? You had a bad day, sucks to be you, yeah. But this path of practice is about not just enduring our suffering, but learning from it. Trying to move in a direction that we will suffer less in the future. So you can always ask yourself, what are you learning from your discontent? Someone says something and you get really offended. What's going on there? Okay, maybe that person, well, you have some thoughts about that person there, but what are you learning here? Why did you have that reaction? What belief of yours has been challenged or violated? Or is there something else going on? So this is a really helpful thing because it means that basically, any situation in life can become part of the practice. Practice doesn't need to be limited to however much formal sitting you do in a day. Any situation in life at any moment can be a source of insight. All we have to do is remember to investigate. What are we learning from this? What's going on here? So, if you are experiencing information overload, then you may or may not be pleased to hear that that is the last of the practices in the Satipatthana Sutta. But the discourse isn't quite done yet. We have a little ending section, which I'll read now. If anyone should develop these four Satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected for that person. Either final knowledge here and now, full awakening, arahantship, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning, third stage of awakening. Let alone 7 years. If anyone should develop these four Satipatthanas in such a way for 6 years, one of two fruits could be expected for that person. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning. Let alone 6 years, 5 years, 4 years, 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months, 3 months, 2 months, 1 month, half a month. If anyone should develop these four Satipatthanas in such a way for 7 days, one of two fruits could be expected for that person. Either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning. It's kind of a shame that this bit's at the end. It would be nice if it was at the start and then you could have used the practice time. Well, you'll know for your next retreat. It goes on. So it was with reference to this that it was said, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana, namely the four Satipatthanas. That is what the Blessed One said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there we go, the Satipatthana Sutta. Just taking a moment here, I always get a little bit emotional reading that last part, actually. So here we are, we have the Satipatthana Sutta. If you are interested in this discourse and you would like further resources to study it more, there are two really good books that I would recommend. Depending on your taste in writing styles, I guess. Bhikkhu Anālayo has a book called Satipatthana, The Direct Path. It's quite a dense book. Anālayo has a scholarly writing style. It's absolutely fascinating. It's full of really great information. It is quite a tough read. So yeah, if depending on how your tastes in reading run, that may or may not be the one for you. A more accessible, equally interesting, and equally comprehensive book is Joseph Goldstein's book that's simply called Mindfulness. And again, yeah, it goes through, both books go through the Satipatthana Sutta, but they also bring in material more widely than that. There are plenty of places where it helps to know some other stuff to understand what's going on. And so actually either book will give you really quite a comprehensive overview of all sorts of different aspects of the path. So definitely recommend both books. If you read the Inalio one, then a lot of the things that I've been dropping in, you will know immediately where they came from. I read Joseph's book after I'd prepared the talks, based on Inalio's stuff. So there's less of Joseph in here, but there's a few bits and pieces that work their way in as well.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.